Actually, it's a change of topics from into magnetic imaging, but it's in fact not a change of materials, because some of the things that we're doing magnetic measurements on are exactly the particles that are being grown at MIT. But I won't be talking too much about them today. What I'd like to do is to start out by telling you about some tools that we're developing for imaging mesoscopics, for imaging magnetism in mesoscopic systems on mesoscopic length scales. And we're not alone in developing these tools by any means, but I'd like to tell you about some of the capabilities that we have, partly because I'm not myself an expert in mesoscopics, and I hope that after hearing this talk, some of you will occasionally think, when you're thinking about different mesoscopic phenomena, wow, gee, I wonder if we could actually measure the magnetism associated with that phenomena, and think about calling me or one of the other people who works on these fields. After I tell you about that, I'd like to tell you about a particular set of two experiments that we've been doing on single vortex structure and dynamics in very underdoped yttrium barium copper oxide. And the tools that I'll be talking about were developed by my graduate students at Stanford. Per Bjornsson and Brian Gardner have been working on squid cell septometry. Cliff Hicks has been working on non-scanning squid cell septometry. Yuju Lin and Janice Nguyen have been working on Hall probe microscopy. And Eric Straver has been working on cantilever torque magnetometry and magnetic force microscopy. OK, so the first question is, why develop mesoscopic magnetic imaging? You know, electrical measurements are really fantastic and generally much more sensitive. Can't you learn everything that you want to know from those? So let me tell you about three projects where I think mesoscopic magnetic imaging is something that's really useful. The first is, I think, the most obvious in superconductivity. There are all kinds of magnetic phenomena in superconductivity on length scales from 1 nanometer, the coherence length, in some superconductors, to the size of the sample. And being able to directly probe those magnetic fields can tell you quite a bit about the underlying structure of the superconductivity. This is an image of something called an interlayer Josephson vortex in a particularly interesting cuprate material, which we imaged, John Kirtley and I imaged at IBM, in order to test a theory of high temperature superconductivity. We heard from Professor Barbara yesterday or the day before yesterday about the wonderful things that you can do by making measurements on very sensitive measurements on small magnetic particles. They've been using squids. We also have squids, and we're working in addition to develop cantilever torque magnetometry so that we can make measurements at very high magnetic fields. This is an SEM photograph of some cobalt nanoparticles from Munji Buendi's group on a cantilever torque magnetometer. And here's some of our initial data on how those particles change the properties, change the resonant properties of the cantilever. At the present time, we're having a hard time actually understanding that data. And I think one of the reasons why we're having a hard time understanding that data is because we really need to get sufficient sensitivity to make measurements on single individual nanoparticles. You can see here, we're looking at quite a few individual nanoparticles, but we don't know how they're crystalline structures are oriented with respect to the cantilever. And in some cases, we have here a clump of 3 9-nanometer cobalt nanoparticles, here a clump of 2 9-nanometer cobalt nanoparticles. Yeah?
Is it really the case that even at the parts per million level, in the absence of any nanoparticles, is there a background to subtract that is the response to the cantilever cells that really
It's really, truly flat. I don't have that data on a view graph, but I can show it to you afterwards. Yeah. Probably, yeah. That's one of the things we need to work on doing. There's a lot of chemistry issues associated with preparing the samples for making the measurement. The third reason for doing mesoscopic magnetic imaging is something that's not obvious to people outside this community, but people inside this community can immediately see the benefit of doing magnetic imaging, of doing magnetic measurements on electronic nanostructures, because you're familiar with the work on persistent currents that was done by Webb's group and by Mai in the early 1990s. So here's an image of a gold ring, which might have a persistent current associated with it at sufficiently low temperatures and small sizes. And here is an image of a squid pickup loop, which is being used to probe the magnetic signal of the gold ring. These measurements so far have been done with stationary squids, with gold rings or gallium arsenide rings actually integrated together with the squid pickup loop. I think there could be a big advantage with using a scanning squid, because you can make much better background measurements if, in a single cool down, you can move the squid over the sample, measure the sample, then move the squid off the sample, measure nothing. And you can also, in that case, measure several rings in one cool down and build up statistics on a ring-by-ring basis so that you know which properties are statistics and which properties are properties of individual rings. Okay, so those are the three projects that we're developing these tools for. Our workhorse tools are Hall probes and SQUID. The Hall probes that we use are gallium arsenide 2D electron gas, pass current this way, measure voltage that way. It tells you the magnetic field perpendicular to the active area of the Hall probe. And you can use it very conveniently for imaging things like experimental hard disk media and magnetic domains and magnetic samples where the signals are very large. But you can also use it, as I'll show you later, for studying some smaller magnetic features. Our SQUIDs are fabricated at Hyperice according to our designs. It's a joint study collaboration with IBM. And our SQUIDs are designed for scanning. And in addition to being designed for scanning, they're also designed to allow us to do both magnetometry and susceptometry. So if you imagine that we have an interesting magnetic particle, which might be a dipole, we have two loops that we can position over it. One is a pickup loop, and we measure the total flux for this pickup loop. And the second is a field coil, and we use a current through this field coil to apply a local magnetic field so that we can measure not only the magnetic moment of that particle, but also the magnetic susceptibility of that particle. And then we actually have two pickup loops and two field coils, and the pickup loops are astatically wound to cancel the background signal. And this is a photo of our pickup loop. The business end of the SQUID is 1.2 millimeters away, and then we have a planar coax which goes to the pickup loop to prevent parasitic pickups in the leads. And right now, this is the fundamental limitation on our spatial resolution, which is that in order to get this coax to prevent parasitic pickup, we need to have the SQUIDs made at Hyperice. So we need to follow Hyperice design rules, which limits us to a certain size. So we'd be really excited about superconducting electronics processes that we're using e-beam lithography. Right now, we have 8 micron by 8 micron square pickup loops. Okay. This is an image of a tin dot going superconducting at a temperature of 3.7 Kelvin. This is an image of a 3-micron tin dot. So you can imagine how you could use this possibly to search for superconductivity in materials where there may be trace amounts of superconductivity, for example. We want to do persistent current measurements. These measurements were made in a pumped helium cryostat. So we needed to build a scanning SQUID susceptometer dilution refrigerator. And this is a photo of our instrument. And we can use it to study vortices in a tungsten thin film. The images of these vortices are a little squirrely because the penetration depth in this film is actually kind of long. This is actually not just a tungsten thin film, but an element of a transition edge sensor used for astrophysics, where they're getting too much noise in the device. And one possibility is that the noise in the device is coming from having vortices that are trapped in the device that are moving around, causing dissipation. And we actually see vortices in the device that are moving in the middle of our scan. We can also measure the susceptibility of this film. And the people who made it assured us that it was one of the most uniform tungsten films ever made, absolutely completely uniform. But you can see that, in fact, there's several regions of the film that are really not superconducting very nicely, even on an 8-micron length scale. And that's actually not uncommon in both magnetic and superconducting materials. It's pretty common to look at a film that people who've been making transport measurements on it assure us is a completely uniform structure and find that even on micron length scales, there's clear evidence of inhomogeneities.
Sorry, could you show the untrained eye how to recognize the thing?
Yeah, I'm sorry. So this is actually a device which I was hoping to gloss over. So there's this. So this large black stripe here is actually a region where there's no tungsten. And there's no tungsten because that's part of the device structure. And then these things here are some aluminum rails which are still superconducting 140 millikelvin. So what you see here is that the susceptibility as a function of position is not uniform in the tungsten film. So if it were uniform, this would all be one color up to the point where you hit that gap. Okay. You can also use this SQUID susceptometer for manipulating individual vortices. So we put this field coil in so that we could make susceptibility measurements. And then when we were imaging vortices, we realized, you know, one of the reasons why we really like using SQUIDs is because with a SQUID, you don't push the vortices around accidentally because it just doesn't put much force on the vortices. But we realized that we could use this field coil to push the vortices around deliberately. So here's an image. This is a 50 micron by 50 micron image. These vortices are resolution limited by the size of the 8 micron square pickup loop. Oh, sorry, it's a 30 micron by 30 micron image. And here we took this vortex and pulled it over here, and then pushed it back over there, and then pulled it over here, using an applied current of a few milliamps. And you can also use it to create vortex anti-vortex pairs. So here's a region of a superconducting sample that has no vortices. And here we've created a vortex anti-vortex pair. And then we scan it. We scanned it about 18 times over 15 minutes. And in the middle of the 19th scan, the vortex anti-vortex pair suddenly annihilated. So we hope that this is going to give us a good way for probing individual pinning energies by looking at the timescales on which these things move when they're left to themselves. Okay, so the workhorses in our toolbox are squids and Hall probes. And the reason why we like these tools is because we know what we're measuring. In the case of the squid, we're measuring the flux through the pickup loop. In the case of the Hall probe, we're measuring the average magnetic field through the active area of the Hall probe. And we like them because they're not very perturbative. They don't exert a large force on the sample. But we don't like them because they only give us micron or perhaps submicron spatial resolution, and they're never going to give us nanometer spatial resolution. If you want to do magnetic imaging with high spatial resolution, the best technique to use is magnetic force microscopy, which is the magnetic imaging technique that people are most familiar with. The reason why we don't use that routinely right now is because, first of all, when you're exerting a force on the cantilever that you're doing magnetic force microscopy with, you're also exerting a force on the sample. And those forces can actually be pretty large compared to subtle, small, length-scale magnetic phenomena. And the second reason is that what you measure with the magnetic force microscopy is the force on the tip, which means that you measure the integral of the gradient of the dot product of the local tip magnetization with the local magnetic field. And if you want to figure out what that means in terms of the magnetization or the magnetic field of the sample, it can be pretty hard to do that deconvolution. So to do magnetic force microscopy at a level where it's as interpretable and as non-invasive as the squid and the Hall probe work, but with much higher spatial resolution, what we really need are to make very sensitive measurements with very low forces, with magnetic tips that have well-controlled shapes and well-controlled magnetic geometries. And that's where we're collaborating with the MIT group to try to make magnetic force microscopes using their cobalt crystals as the active element in the MFM. So this is an image of a cantilever with a nanotube tip. And this is an image of a multi-walled nanotube, unfortunately not the same nanotube, but a multi-walled nanotube with a 9-nanometer cobalt nanoparticle, we believe covalently bonded onto the end of the nanotube tip. So working to use these elements as the active sensors in magnetic force microscopes in the future may give us much higher spatial resolution magnetic force microscopy. This work, by the way, was done by a sophomore chemistry undergraduate working in my lab last summer. Okay, so that's everything I wanted to say about mesoscopic magnetic imaging. And now I would like to tell you about some experiments we've been doing in superconductivity, where we're studying single vortex flux quantization and dynamics. And the reason why we're studying it is because it's a test of an idea of the mechanism of high temperature superconductivity, which is called spin charge separation or electron fractionalization. So let me explain about flux quantization and why flux quantization is related to spin charge separation. And the work that I'll be talking about here was done primarily by Brian Gardner and Janice Wynn in my lab on samples from the University of British Columbia, working together with Doug Bond, who's been visiting the laboratory for the last year on a Stacey Fellowship from Canada. Okay, magnetic flux in superconductors is quantized in units of 8C over 2E, 20.7 Gauss micron squared. And that factor of 2 in the denominator comes from the fact that you have Cooper pairs in superconductors. So a Cooper pair circling a flux of magnitude 8C over 2E acquires a 2 pi phase shift. And that's where flux quantization comes from. This was first shown in 1961. And actually, if you look at this volume of Physical Review Letters, it's kind of very interesting sociologically, I think. They have two experimental papers, one of them reporting flux quantization of 8C over 2E, the other reporting flux quantization of HC over E with a 40% systematic error of unknown origin. Both papers do not speculate on why you might have HC over 2E, but instead refer to theory papers. There's two theory papers that accompany these two experimental papers, where the theorists point out that the factor of 2 might indicate that the charge carriers are carrying charge 2E. So it looks to me like the relationship between experimentalists and theorists was really very different in 1961 than it is now. I can't imagine any experimentalist I know resisting the urge to make that speculation in print with data like this. Okay, so that's in conventional superconductors. It's conventional wisdom that magnetic flux is quantized in units of HC over 2E in all superconductors. This was the earliest experiment that demonstrated that in cuprate superconductors. In 1987, shortly after the discovery, Colin Guff and his collaborators showed that you could move individual HC over 2E fluxoids in and out of a large ring of superconductor, which had a superconducting transition where the onset was 85 Kelvin and the transition completed at 50 Kelvin. Today we would call that a wildly inhomogeneous sample, but at the time it was a very good sample. And it's also a sample that we'd call optimally doped, which means that it has close to the maximum TC. In fact, there have been hundreds, if not thousands, if not tens of thousands of experiments in samples of this particular doping range having close to the maximum TC, where if you did not have HC over 2E flux quanta, it would just hit you over the head and you would realize that you didn't have HC over 2E flux quanta. So the fact that it's conventional wisdom that flux is quantized in terms of HC over 2E in high temperature superconductors isn't that surprising. There's this idea, I don't want to say theory because there's various implementations of it that could be individually called theories, but there's this idea that the mechanism of superconductivity in some unconventional superconductors, not only high TC superconductors, but possibly other ones as well, might be spin charge separation, which is sometimes also called electron fractionalization. So in spin charge separation, what happens is that you take an electron, which is a charge E spin a half fermion, and you put it into this strongly correlated quasi two-dimensional system with all these other electrons, and it breaks up into two excitations, one of which is a charge on, which is a charge E spin zero boson. This charge on could also be called a hole on, depending on who your favorite theorists are. And the other one of them is a spin-on, which is a charge zero spin-a-half fermion. And then this is a simple version of spin-charge separation. You could also have more complicated forms of spin-charge separation. But this is the one that most people talk about. Okay, and then you see what happens. You have these charge-ons, which are charge-y bosons. Well, once you have charge-y bosons, you don't need to form Cooper pairs to get superconductivity. You have charge-y bosons. The charge-y bosons can condense and give you a condensate of charge-e carrying particles. And naively, you would think that if you had condensation of charge E bosons, magnetic flux would be quantized in units of HC over E, not units of HC over 2E, like it is when you have condensation of Cooper pairs. So actually, as early as 1988, Killison, Roxar, and Cephna wrote a paper that basically saved spin charge separation in the context of HC over 2E flux quanta having already been observed. They wrote this paper called 2E or not 2E, in which they pointed out that depending on the detailed parameters in your model, you could get either HC over E or HC over 2E flux quantization in a spin charge separated superconductor. A couple years later, in the early 90s, Sachdev and then Nagaosa and Lee sort of fleshed that out a little bit. What does it mean that you could get either HC over E or HC over 2E? And they did this independently of any particular microscopic model, but simply in a Ginzburg-Landau theory of a spin-charge-separated superconductor. They said, look, the energy of a vortex consists of the energy of the superfluid part of the vortex, that's the energy that it costs to make this little cylinder of magnetic flux, plus the energy of the core, that's the energy that it costs to suppress this even littler cylinder of condensate. And in simple Ginzburg-Landau theory, if you have a flux quantum that carries twice as much magnetic flux, you still only have to suppress the superconductivity right in the core, so the core energy is the same, but now you have twice as much magnetic field, the energy of the magnetic field goes like B squared, so you have four times as much superfluid energy, so you never get H over E flux quanta. But in a spin charge separated superconductor, these papers point out, the core energies of an HC over E and an HC over 2E core would not be identical. They would be different. And depending on how the specific balance of those core energies worked out compared to the superfluid energy, you could get either energetically preferred HC over E flux quanta or energetically preferred HC over 2E flux quanta. And at that time, these theorists asked some experimentalists to look for HC over E flux quanta in a particular range of doping called the very underdoped samples. This is a high TC phase diagram showing temperature versus doping. Doping being the number of carriers on the planes, or sometimes, depending on whether it's a theorist or an experimentalist who draws the phase diagram, this can either mean some chemical composition, such as the number of oxygens in yttrium, barium, copper, oxide sub 6 plus X, or it can mean the number of carriers on the plane if someone's doing a calculation. Those two are related, but not in any particularly simple way. Okay. So optimally doped materials are those that have the highest TC. Underdoped materials are those that have fewer carriers than the amount of carriers required to give you the highest TC. And the lower the doping is, the lower the carrier concentration is, the lower the superfluid energy of the vortex is. So based on that, Sachdev said that you would see HC over E vortices, and that you would see them in a spin charge separated superconductor, you would see them in the region closest to this phase boundary at high temperatures in the underdoped materials. And then if you take this paper by Nagaoth and Lee, and everywhere they have an approximately equal to sign or a Gose-like sign, you make it exactly equal to, which is a completely unfair thing to do. But if you do that, you can actually get quantitative numbers for where you should see H over E vortices. At the time that these guys did this theory, those samples didn't really exist. And so people kind of looked in the underdoped region, but they didn't push it really quantitatively, and the results were never checked that carefully. Sentel and Fisher, in the year 2000, did a much more quantitative microscopic model. And so I want to spend just a minute or two explaining what their microscopic model is, because it gives you an actual number for the energy difference between the core energies of the HC over E and the HC over 2E vortices. Okay, so basically, in their model, you have this spin-charge separation. So you have your electron, which breaks up into your charge-on and your spin-on. And that always seems a little bit fishy, because after all, they were once electrons, and somehow they still have to know about each other. This is my very anthropomorphic view of the Z2 gauge theory. For more details, I can refer you to the relevant 20-something page PRB paper by Sentel and Fisher. Okay, so somehow the charge-ons and the spin-ons have to keep track of each other so that if they go around together, they still act like a fermion. And the way that they keep track of each other is through the Z2 gauge field. And the Z2 gauge field is something that can change the phase of the charge-on by pi when the charge-on jumps from one location to another location. So every time the charge-on crosses a link here, it can either change its phase by nothing, which would be plus one, or it can change its phase by pi, which would be minus one. So that's what the Z2 gauge field does. And you can have a topological defect in the Z2 gauge field, which they call a Vison, because it's a vortex in an Ising-like model. And so this Vison is something that when the charge-on goes around the Vison, the charge-on acquires a phase change of pi. Okay, so then you can forget about the Z2 gauge field and just think about Visons. If you have a Vison and the charge-on goes around the Vison, it acquires a phase change of pi. And that immediately tells you in a very intuitive way how you could have a condensate of charge E bosons and still get HC over 2E flux quantization. Because if you have a Vison in the center of every vortex core, then when the charge-on circles the Vison plus circling the HC over 2E vortex, it picks up a pi phase shift from the Vison, a pi phase shift from the HC over 2E vortex, it comes back with a phase change of 2 pi, and it's happy. Okay. What that means is that every HC over 2E vortex has to have a Vison with it. And the Vison, the theoretical prediction with some support from photoemission data, is that the energy scale for spin charge separation, which is the energy scale for Visons, is this energy scale called the pseudo gap. So again, here's the high TC phase diagram, temperature versus doping. And the pseudo gap is an experimentally observed energy scale that increases with decreasing doping. Okay, so the experimental consequences of this prediction are, first of all, that when the Vison energy is sufficiently large, which would be over here, and when the superfluid energy is sufficiently small, which fortunately would also be over here, because this is where the superfluid energy is small, so in the very underdoped materials, you have the highest Vison energy and the smallest superfluid density. When those two conditions are met, then this term dominates, and HC over E vortices would be energetically favored. The other experimental consequence is that if you could study single vortex dynamics, they would occur on some exponentially activated timescale, which depends on the energy of the vortex. And you would notice that they're much slower than expected because that vortex is carrying around this Vison, which has an extra energy associated with it. Okay. So in the meantime, while that theory was going on, the sample growth in yttrium barium copper oxide, which are unusually clean samples for high TC, caught up with the theoretical need for very underdoped materials. So here is an experimental phase diagram now showing TC as a function of doping. The black data points are from the literature, a paper by John Lurum in 1993, which is often cited as the canonical phase diagram. You can see here that the lowest TC material on the underdoped side has a TC of 30 Kelvin. And I can tell you that if you look up this paper, you'll find out that it not only has a TC of 30 Kelvin, but it also has a transition width of about 30 Kelvin. These are the new samples grown by the University of British Columbia in the last 2 years, grown by Ruixing Ling at UBC. And they have TCs. For example, here's one of the samples we studied with a TC, onset TC of 12.7 Kelvin, and a transition width ranging from 12 to 12.7 Kelvin. And here's a sample with a TC of onset TC of 5.3 Kelvin and a transition width of about 2 Kelvin. So the samples improved quite a bit, and we now have available the very underdoped samples that we need to test this theoretical prediction. Okay, so we're going to use squid microscopy and Hall probe microscopy to look at the vortices and see what the flux quantization actually is. This is the magnetic field associated with an isolated vortex trapped on a microscopic defect in a superconductor. It's not in the Abrikosov state, it's just a single isolated vortex. And as you pass your sample above, as you pass your sensor above the sample, you see that measuring the perpendicular component of the magnetic field, you'll see a peak in the perpendicular component of the magnetic field. So these are images of the flux quantum in what's called an ortho 2 sample with a TC of 50 Kelvin, slightly underdoped, and a sample with a TC of 12 Kelvin at 2.1 Kelvin and measuring it at 6.3 Kelvin. And from both fitting that data to a model for the shape of the vortex convolved with the shape of the squid pickup loop, and from integrating the total flux in these images, we find that the flux quantum is in fact HC over 2E in these materials. We looked at 110 distinct fluxoids between 2 and 7 Kelvin in three samples. All the samples had TC of about 12 Kelvin, and we never saw any evidence for HC over E fluxoids. The other point that I want to make here is that this image here shows you a resolution-limited vortex. The shape of the vortex is the shape of the pickup loop. It's not the shape of the image of the vortex is the shape of the pickup loop. It's an 8 micron by 8 micron square pickup loop. This vortex is actually about 0.3 microns by 0.3 microns. Here in the underdoped materials, the vortices are carrying the same amount of flux, but they look a little blurry. They look a little more spread out. And that shows you that the size of the vortex in these materials that are, you know, very underdoped but not yet with TC equals zero, the size of the vortex is already approaching micron length scales, such that we can already see the vortex spreading even with an 8 micron pickup loop. So we went to our 2 micron Hall probes. Hopefully we're going to have 3rd micron Hall probes in the next month or so. But we went to our 2 micron Hall probes to look at these vortices. And these are resolution limited vortices in an optimally doped yttrium barium copper oxide sample image with a Hall probe. These are vortices in a very underdoped TC equals 12 Kelvin YBCO. And these vortices are noticeably more spread out than those vortices. In this image, you can really only see that the peak height is smaller. But if I plot the same data with so that the amplitude of the color scale is the maximum amplitude of the color scale is the same on both data sets, you can see that in the very underdoped material, the vortices, the size of this vortex cylinder is much larger than it is in the optimally doped material. And again, that tells you that the size of the vortex, and hence the magnetic penetration depth, is something of order a micron or two. The other thing you can see here is that, remember, the prediction was that these vortices were most likely at low doping and high temperatures. And with the Hall probe, we can look at slightly higher temperatures than we can look at with the squid. So we can see that even at higher temperatures, although the vortices get kind of squirrely looking, we can still say that they're HC over 2 vortices. we can use the optically doped data basically as an image of a point source to measure the resolution function of the Hall probe. And then when we do that, we can fit the data in the underdoped sample more quantitatively, and we can extract actual numbers for the penetration depth, which gives us a penetration depth ranging from 1 micron at low temperatures to a couple of microns at higher temperatures. And altogether, we imaged 60 vortices from 2 to about 10.5, 11 Kelvin, where we couldn't really make a quantitative statement about the flux anymore, in one sample with TC of 12 Kelvin. And again, we found no evidence for HC over E-fluxoids. And I think this is the first time that anybody's really actually looked in this range of doping to see whether the flux quantization is HC over 2E or HC over E. Okay, so the interpretation of that is that if our data means that 2 HC over 2E fluxoids are energetically preferred over 1 HC over E fluxoid, then the Vison energy is less than superfluid energy. You can just get that from a couple lines of algebra from the equations I had on the second or third view graph. And that tells us that the Vison, very conservatively taking the penetration depth as 1 micron, that tells us the Vison energy is less than 60 Kelvin. And you want to compare that to the theoretical prediction of the pseudogap energy, which in these samples is believed to be 500 to 700 Kelvin. So that means that the theorists need to find a factor of at least 2 pi, maybe 2 pi squared or so, in their theory in order to keep this class of spin charge separation theories alive. But there's 2 serious caveats on this data. The one that's more serious in my mind is the possibility that what we're actually measuring is not the truly energetically favored vortex configuration, but some metastable state. If you had an HC over E flux quantum, even if it were energetically preferred, if there was some process that would allow it to break up into 2 HC over 2E flux quanta, even if they could lower their energy by recombining, they'd never recombine because they repel each other over a length scale of the penetration depth, which is a micron. They repel each other until the cores are overlapping, which is about a 10 angstrom distance. So once they break up, they're not coming back together again. Okay, so Sentel anticipated that and proposed a really ingenious experiment, which we call the Sentel experiment, based on the statement that the dynamics of a single fluxoid will be exponentially activated on some time scale, which depends on the vortex energy, which may or may not have a contribution of a Vison energy associated with it. Okay, so he proposed that you take a superconductor with a hole in it and trap a single vortex in it. Actually, trap some number of vortices in it, but let's say you just trap a single vortex in it. Then you heat it up above its transition temperature as quickly as you can. When you heat it up above its transition temperature, the vortex is lost because it's not superconducting anymore. But the Vison is still trapped in the hole. And the Vison can get out of the hole on a time scale, which again is this exponentially activated time scale, because the Vison energy doesn't go to zero at TC, unlike the vortex energy. Okay, so you have this trapped Vison. Then you cool it back down again, and as long as you did it quickly enough, you would regenerate a spontaneous HC over E flux quantum in that cylinder, but now it could be either a positive HC over E flux, HC over 2E flux quantum or a negative HC over 2E flux quantum. Because all that you need is that the circulating currents will allow the phases of the chargeons to be happy, and that they can either get a pi phase shift or a minus pi phase shift, and that'll work. Okay, and then you can further check, so you can check for systematic errors by looking for this even-odd effect. And you can further check for systematic errors by trapping odd number, by trapping both odd and even numbers of HC over 2E flux quanta. If you trap an even number of HC over 2E flux quanta, then you don't have any Visons in the hole, and you wouldn't see any vortex memory effect. You only see a vortex memory effect if you have an odd number of Visons trapped in the hole, an odd number of HC over 2E flux quanta trapped in the hole. Okay, so we need very underdoped samples with holes. So we took these samples that Doug Bond brought down to the lab from UBC, and took them to FIB International in Sunnyvale and drilled some holes in them. And this is a picture of a 50 micron by 50 micron sample. It got to be 50 microns because Doug Bond cut it with a razor blade and then embedded it in silver epoxy, a new style of doing fabrication on micron length scales. And then we drilled this 10 micron hole in the center of it at FIB International. And let me actually skip ahead and just show you one representative data set. Okay, So this is that sample, which had a TC of slightly over of about 11 Kelvin. But we found that the vortices actually escaped after cycling to 9.5 Kelvin. So here we have a vortex trapped in the hole, minus one vortex, minus two vortex, all the way up to six vortices trapped in the hole. We cycled to 9.5 Kelvin for 10 seconds, and then we cool back down again. And irrespective of how many vortices we have trapped in the hole, if we cool back down at zero field, we never find any vortices in the hole when we cool back down. Okay, so we've done that experiment on four samples, which have TCs of 12 Kelvin, 7 Kelvin, and 6 Kelvin. And we never saw any evidence for vortex memory above or near TC. So in our most rigorous experiment, which was the last one, we had vortex escape times, which our upper limit on the vortex escape time was 1 second at 5.6 Kelvin. And so we can use that to send a quantitative limit on the vortex energy and hence on the Vinet-Poisson energy, that the escape time is some microscopic attempt times times e to the e vortex over kt, which is less than 1 second. Now, the problem is that we don't know the microscopic attempt time. And actually, we would really like to measure, to know the microscopic attempt time. In the future, we hope to do direct measurements of the microscopic attempt time from looking at thermally activated vortex behavior, which might, in the end, be the most interesting thing to come out of this set of experiments. And I hope that at some point there's going to be more theoretical work on that, because I think it's incredibly difficult to do theoretical calculations of the microscopic attempt times of something like a vortex jumping out of a ring. But it sure would be neat to have that theoretical information available. There have been some estimates 20 or so years ago. Okay, so we don't know what the microscopic attempt time is, but we figure it's probably not smaller than the size of one plaquette divided by the Fermi velocity. We weren't sure if we should use as our estimate the size of one plaquette divided by the Fermi velocity or the size of the sample divided by the speed of light. But it turned out that those both were very similar upper limits of 2 times 10 to the minus 15 seconds. So with that rather conservative estimate for the microscopic attempt time, we can say that the energy of a Vison is less than 190 Kelvin. And keep in mind that this experiment is more rigorous than the previous experiment, which had those two caveats about the vortex dynamics and the phase transition. So you compare this to the theoretical prediction of 500 to 700 Kelvin, and then the theorists have, I think, a pretty good motivation to go and look for a factor of 2 pi in their theoretical estimate. And it also gives us a good motivation to try to get another factor of 2 or 4 or so in our experiments. So we hope to get that factor of 2 or 4 by making measurements of telegraph noise in individual rings, and we've been working to increase the bandwidth of our squid electronics to the point where we can actually do those measurements up to hopefully megahertz timescales in the not too distant future. And we plan to do these on both very underdoped YBCO and also on conventional superconductors. So here I could repeat my plea for theorists who are interested in working on microscopic attempt times. But I'm running out of time, so I won't. Okay, thank you very much. Which parameter? It's a good question. We don't actually know. In the estimates that we took for the energy based on the single vortex experiments, we treated it as we just took the value for the optimally doped materials. But in fact, the coherence length in these very underdoped materials is not known. Both the coherence length and the penetration depth should increase. But I'm not so sure. I mean, in a BCS superconductor, you could say they're going to increase like this. But in these superconductors, I think we better actually make the measurements before we extrapolated kappa values from the higher temperature data. Yes. Ah, okay. It could be. It does. It's definitely not type one though, because we're yeah. How low in temperature? We only went down to temperatures of about 2 Kelvin, 1.8 Kelvin in a couple of samples and 2.7 Kelvin in another sample while our pump was broken.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. It would be interesting to work out the numbers for the entropy on that. I haven't. It's something I've never thought about, but that's a good idea. I think even if it did, even if that did turn out to be the case that it were that it was because of entropy that you got HC over 2E vortices at higher temperatures, we probably still would never see them, because if you have to go through a region where you have favored HC over 2E vortices, then I think they're still not going to go back together, because you're just not going to reach that equilibrium.
They're
favored energetically. It depends on the doping. At zero temperature, they're favored energetically in this narrow sliver of doping, which, you know, if you took Nagoshi and Lee's papers and just wrote all these equal signs in, it would be for doping less than 0.04. And for the numbers of the Sentel-Fisher numbers, it's when 7 pi TC is less than the pseudo gap temperature, which is a very similar result. And we're in that range. We're in that range where the theoretical prediction is that even at zero temperature, they should be energetically favored.
So for a bison to be trapped in that hole above TC, does that mean that there is a current above TC?
No, there's no current associated with the bison above TC. Basically, if you have the bison, then a charge-on going around the bison still acquires a phase change of pi. But above TC, there is no macroscopic phase coherence for the charge-on, so it doesn't bother them to have a phase change of pi when they circle a bison.
So that means there's no magnetic field?
There's no magnetic field above TC. Right. And as far as I can tell, as far as anything I've been able to think of or ask other people about, there's actually no way to detect the bison above, no mesoscopic way to detect the bison above TC. You can infer their presence from this evidence for spin charge separation in the photo emission. But the actual detection of a bison is very difficult. There's not much that couples to it.
Everybody's. Thank you very much. Yeah.